The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
And now, it's time for the talk of the Northwest, the 9 to noon show with Greg Hughes on Highland Radio.
Hello, good morning to you. 4 minutes past nine on this Thursday, the 4th of May, 2023. Good morning, SSA. How are you doing? I hope you're very well indeed. And you're very welcome along to another show where hopefully we'll keep you informed and entertained over the next 3 hours. Lots coming up on the show. We're going to be talking about all the big stories of the day. We have Mark Cohen coming on to discuss the expected interest rate hike today. The European Central Bank expected to put on 0.25% interest rate hike. So if you have any questions about your mortgage, or maybe you're a first-time buyer or trying to become a first-time buyer, or maybe you're on a variable, or maybe you are on a tracker and you want any advice in that regard, get in touch with us and I'll give you the numbers for that and for whatever else you want to speak to us about. We're also going to be talking about the fall in the price of milk and butter and what impact that might have on consumers, but also, of course, on producers. 086 60 25000, that's the WhatsApp and text number, 086 60 25000, or give us a call on 074 91 25000, and your emails come into us at comments@highlandradio.com. All right, Thursday morning, lots of papers. Let's crack on with a look at the front of the Tyrconnell Tribune. Deputy Padraig McLaughlin has told the Tribune, that information emerging in recent days about a reduction of ophthalmic physicians. I know the word, but you know when sometimes you just can't get it out. Ophthalmic physicians at Letterkenny, at the community services at the St. Connell's campus in Letterkenny is a very worrying trend. My apologies for stuttering through that. I fear there is a management agenda in the HSE to send people from as far away as Malinhead and Fannet to Sligo for treatment because of one reason: lack of doctors on the community campus in Letterkenny. Surely the people of Donegal deserve more consideration than that, says McLaughlin. The Donegal News this morning: council behind major land purchase. News that Donegal County Council is behind the purchase of the recently sold 8.23-acre site in the centre of Letterkenny is expected to be confirmed today. Councillors in the Letterkenny Milford Municipal District are to attend a special meeting and workshop today as part of ongoing discussions over the draft Letterkenny plan and local transport plan. It's understood details of the recent purchase of the site, which is located behind the town's fire station at High Road, will be revealed. News of the sale of the land was confirmed last month by Henry McCahy, Director of Local Estate Agents, DNG Boyce Gallagher. However, details of the agreed sale price and buyer were not disclosed. The site had gone on the market last year at a price of €4 million. Euro. The Donegal Democrat: adequate water is vital for Bundoran summer. Local business people have said ongoing water pipe repairs in Bundoran are absolutely necessary if the town is to have a prosperous summer. Councillor Michael McMahon said it was imperative the work gets carried out now. Water mains are crucial for the continuing supply of water around the town, he said. It's important that they get fixed as soon as can be done, as the amount of water used, especially during the summer months, is greater than at other times of the year. The Derry News is the last of the locals this morning. Migrant workers could hold the key to addressing the ongoing shortage of taxi drivers in Derry. In the first joint initiative of its kind in the city, the Northwest Migrants Forum has linked up with Foyle Taxi Company to encourage those from minoritised communities to consider a career in the cab industry. Founded in 2012, the Northwest Migrant Forum is a network of individuals working together to tackle racial inequality and prejudice. The organisation's fundamental goal is to support and advise members of black and community ethnic communities who reside in the north. So they're trying to link up vacancies in taxi work with members of the migrant population. The Farmers' Journal this morning: Irish grain supplies are set to nosedive this harvest and straw availability will take a serious hit as the cereal area plummets. Irish Farmers' Journal analysis is forecasting a 17,400 euro hectare drop in cereal crop this harvest. Wheat, barley and oats output is set to fall by around 440,000 or almost 20,000 compared to 2022, while straw supplies will be cut by more than 400,000 round bales. On to the Nationals now. Let's start with the Irish Independent. And we read that consumers are set to see the prices of grocery staples such as milk and butter, fall further as big retailers continue their price war. Price cuts are being passed on to consumers as supermarkets chains battle to maintain their market share by cutting the cost of dairy products. They're also cutting prices for consumers in reaction to falls globally in commodity prices. But the price war that has broken out on milk and butter comes at a time when grocery price inflation has been at record levels. Now, price war, I mean, we are seeing a slight reduction in the price of milk and butter, but it's still far and away ahead of what it was 2 years ago. So we don't want to be sold a pup here, do we? Supermarkets, as I say, are keen to target consumers who are visiting for smaller, more regular shopping trips, hence the faces, the focus on staples. Professor Michael Wallace of UCD, an expert in farm economics, said Irish shoppers can expect to see more cuts in the price of dairy products. He said this was mainly due to a fall in global dairy commodity prices, such as fertiliser and feed inputs. Farmers, are you seeing that reduction in fertiliser and feed inputs that are being reported in the papers today? Reading on here, there was also an undersupply of commodities last year, but now we're seeing the opposite and demand weakened last year. We are seeing some excess in commodity supply in world's markets, putting downward pressure on prices. But as I say, the price of stuff still 16% up year on year. So any fall is to be welcome, but let's not forget where we're at either. On to the Irish Times now, and the chief executive of Web Summit, Paddy Cosgrave, who lives in South Donegal, he's written to Dáil authorities saying his reputation has been adversely affected by remarks made in the Dáil by tarnished Micheál Martin. It comes after Mr. Martin described investigative website The Ditch as a political organisation that wants to attack and undermine confidence in the government, and he said he did not see the website as an independent media platform. His remarks came amid opposition questions related to a controversy surrounding Fianna Fáil junior minister Niall Collins. Mr. Collins has been the subject of a series of stories by The Ditch raising questions about his wife's purchase of a property from Limerick County Council in 2008. There's no need for the background to that story. But in the Dáil remarks last week, Mr. Martin said The Ditch was partly funded by Mr. Cosgrave, while another individual, Che Bowes, was a founding member of the website. He said both were political opponents of the government, and Mr. Martin said he would love to know who's funding The Ditch in its entirety. Well, Web Summit is that information was released subsequently during an interview at the weekend. But anyway, Paddy Cosgrave written to the Dáil saying that his reputation has been damaged through Micheál Martin's remarks, which were made using Dáil privilege. On to the Irish Daily Mail now, and it may not surprise you to learn that 9 out of 10 nurses and midwives say their work has left them burnt out, and even more fears it has harmed their psychological well-being, a shocking survey has revealed. And things under severe pressure in the hospitals. Last evening, contacted by a mother who was in the hospital with her daughter in there since 5:30 in the afternoon. By 10 or 11 o'clock, they still hadn't been seen. And at that point, someone came out to the emergency department and said, look, if you don't need to be seen, go home. So it's an ongoing crisis, even though we don't talk about it all of the time. But I'd be contacted regularly in the evenings by people who note how tough it is. And the reason I mentioned that case is the one thing the person did say as well is that they felt very sorry for the staff having to work in that environment. And that, again, here is reflected in this survey. Hospital overcrowding, long hours and staff shortages are leaving healthcare staff feeling exhausted, with 3/4 of those surveyed saying they had considered leaving their job in the last month. The concerning figures released by the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation started its annual conference yesterday and sparked a Dáil row with Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald telling Taoiseach Leo Varadkar that the health system is on its knees. On to the Irish Star this morning, and Gardaí are now probing the theory that a mother of two whose body was found in her home died a violent death. The Star has established that the post-mortem on Angela Canavan was inconclusive, which means the cause of the woman's death cannot be given definitively. But sources have told the paper investigating the death in Sligo Town on Monday evening that they now suspect she died from foul play. The post-mortem was inconclusive, but there is something not quite right about this case, a source said. On to the Sun this morning, and a double drone attack at the Kremlin yesterday sparked fears of a massive upsurge in violence in Putin's Ukraine invasion. Russia accused Ukraine of trying to assassinate President Vladimir Putin and vowed retaliatory measures. But Ukraine claimed Moscow had staged the false flag attack itself to justify more slaughter. President Volodymyr Zelensky insisted, "We didn't attack Putin or Moscow. We fight on our own territory." And it would be a peculiar attack in that there were people climbing up the roof before the drone even arrived, which I thought was a little bit strange. And it was a drone of the size, not like the drones with the wings that we've seen landing. It was actually a four-propeller drone. And it didn't seem it could do any damage at all, really, and it didn't. And Putin wasn't there. But overnight, and it's not in the papers this morning, of course, overnight, Russia unleashed a volley of missiles right across cities in the Ukraine. And finally, in the Irish Daily Mirror this morning, more than 4,500 official reports of child sex abuse were made to Tuzla last year. A charity has described the new figures as really worrying. A select group of people can make mandated reports of abuse to the Child and Family Agency, including doctors, nurses, Gardaí, teachers and youth workers. What's happening in this country where we have, and it's not just this year, it happens every year, 4,500 reports of child sex abuse made to Tuzla last year. It really is absolutely shocking. That's an awful lot of young, innocent children affected. That's an awful lot of perpetrators. I just don't know what we're going to do about it, but we have to do something about it instead of constantly fearing about what's going to happen to our children. And I get that too, and it's an important conversation. But my word, we really need to focus on the here and now and what's been happening historically. 4,500 official reports of child sex abuse made to Tuzla last year. This at the same time as a former GP, completely unconnected, a former GP has received a fully suspended sentence of 1 year's imprisonment for the possession and distribution of sexually explicit images of children. Dublin Circuit Criminal Court heard Ronan Keegan, 51, was involved in thrill-seeking behaviour and was meeting many women for sex and had sent out and received naked photos to and from many women of all ages. But he was eventually caught with those images in his possession, but escapes jail. Right, OK. I hope I can speak to Mark Keown, founder of MoneySherpa.ie. Are you there, Mark?
Hi, I'm here, Greg.
Wow, OK, thankfully. Good to have you on the show again. How are you keeping?
Yeah, I'm very good, thanks. Very
That's good.
Good,
OK. Right, we're expecting, aren't we, a further interest rate increase today. No surprise, obviously, today or yesterday, because we knew it was coming, but has it been on the cards?
It has been on the cards. There's been a little bit of debate about whether this was going to happen because of the banking crisis that we spoke about around a month ago. However, the latest forecasts are that the ECB Monetary Council is expected to announce what they call a rate increase in the refi rate, the refinance rate, the rate that they lend money to banks. So we're expecting a rate increase of 0.25 or 0.5, depending on how hawkish the bank is. And that announcement should be at 2 p.m. this afternoon. And that's actually the 10th increase this year. So it really has been a march of hikes for the last 12 months.
Okay, well, let's break it down as to how this might affect people. So what about your typical mortgage, as much as we can call it typical, for someone on variable rates at the moment?
Yeah, so this change will mostly affect the tracker customers because they're directly linked to the ECB rate, so they'll be the first to see the impact. So the average tracker mortgage rate is going to rise from it was 1.15 in June last year, and a 0.25 increase rate, the lower rate, will take it to 4.9. And if they go for the full whack, the 0.5, that will actually take the average tracker to over 5%, to 5.15%. So on those rates, the cost of an average tracker mortgage will have increased by over 30,000 over the full term from this time last year. So that's 2,500 per year. It's over €100 per month. So it really, for customers on trackers, there's just been a massive change.
So what should they do? Because it's quite possible that someone on a tracker, if they got it, say, you know, 2006 or something, were paying a higher rate. And then we got into this period of arguably and possibly artificial low rates that we might not see again. And now we are edging up to 5.1%, as you say. So if you've got 10, 15 years left on your tracker mortgage, do you stick with it if you can afford it? Or is it the time to try and fix if you can? Because, you know, there is a feeling, I think, that interest rates may not go up a great deal higher and might actually even come back somewhat.
Yeah, so the general consensus is that we may be reaching the peak of the interest rate cycle, although there has been some false dawns on this before, and the truth is nobody actually knows. So what we advise people in general is, if you can fix, to fix because of the certainty that it gives you. So for certain people who've got a lot of affordability, riding out the wave may be the sensible thing. But for the majority of people, the sound financial advice is to avoid them possibly getting into trouble on their home. That's the biggest risk. And that risk far outweighs the benefit of maybe getting lucky and paying a little bit less in your repayments. So there are actually 130,000 tracker customers who have still yet to fix. We've seen 58,000 come off trackers in the last 2 years. So there's been a massive movement away from trackers as people have looked to cap. But there's still a lot of customers there who potentially could still fix. And the rates haven't really risen as much as you might expect. So it's still possible to fix at 3.19. And if you remember, Greg, I just mentioned the average track is now at is going to be at least 4.9. So that would save you around 14,000. So it'd save you about half of the increase that we've seen from the ECB.
Is there any scenario whereby your bank, if you're on a tracker, will not allow you to fix your mortgage? Because I seem to recall last time we talked about this, someone saying that they weren't allowed to fix it.
Yeah, so if you're with a retail bank, if you're with one of the high street lenders, one of the pillar banks, then that's not the case. You can either fix with your current bank and they will offer you rates, or you can switch to an alternative bank. And I would encourage people to talk to a broker about the rates that are out there, because it won't surprise you, Greg, but the most expensive lenders are the main banks. So generally, if you talk to a broker, they can probably, rather than fixing with the bank you're with, the best way to get a deal is to talk to a broker and get on another rate. However, unfortunately, there are around 60,000 customers with the Vulture Funds who are what we call mortgage prisoners, who there is no fixed rate if you're with a Vulture Fund. And now you can switch away in theory to a retail bank if you're with a Vulture Fund. However, there are 60,000 customers who won't be accepted by the high street banks.
The non-performing loans, are they?
Yeah, well, some of them are non-performing, but, and this is a misconception that's out there, but a lot of them are performing. People have paid their rates, but unfortunately, they don't quite make the affordability criteria for the new. So they've always paid their bills, but they can't switch away because, let's say, the circumstances have changed. Or, and I think this is really important to remember, when the banks were handing out silly money back in 2006, 2005, you know, they might have got 100% mortgage over a 40-year term. This is the crazy stuff that was going on back then. And now the banks are saying, oh, no, we're all proper and serious and we can't accept you, even though they put them on the terms in originally.
What kind of rates are people with Vulture Funds paying currently?
It does range, but some of them are quite horrendous. So I mentioned the tracker customers earlier on, and they're the people who've seen the increase in rates. With the retail banks, the high street lenders, variable rates have only just started to rise. So AIB put 0.35% through in February. I do expect Bank of Ireland and Permanent TSB to follow with these rates. So we'll also see variable rates rise. But the Vulture Fund have been putting these rates through on trackers and variables from the start. And that means that some of the variables now are on 8 and 9%. feel really penal lately.
Yeah, and of course, when we talk about switching and all that type of stuff too, there's a lot of people listening in this region who have houses that are affected by defective concrete as well, and they are trapped, and some of them are trapped with the vulture funds as well at those excessive high rates. So it's a double, triple and quadruple whammy for some of those. Right. So you mentioned there about the variable rates at the moment with the pillar banks, the people just on variable rates. The banks have, I wouldn't say absorbed it, but they haven't really been increasing as such. You've mentioned some increases. The sense is that now, is it not, with this latest increase, that even if your mortgage hasn't increased on a variable rate recently, it's probable, if not likely, that it will after this next round of rate increases.
Yeah. So it won't surprise you to know, Greg, that the banks haven't been capping the variable rates, not passing through the increases out of the goodness of their hearts. What they've been doing is they've been keeping the deposit rates really low. And they've been taking, there are billions at the moment in deposit accounts. They've been popping those in offshore banks themselves, and they've been getting 3% on that. So they've been making an absolute pile. You can see this in the accounts of the banks that have recently been released. However, there is pressure competitively. There's now a 2% rate available in Ireland through a company called Trade Republic. And there's talk of Revolut offering that rate. They're not in the market yet, but I would be counting the days to potentially them doing that. So if the banks sit on those low deposit rates, there's a risk they'll lose all that money, and that money will go elsewhere and seek higher rates. Mm. So they'll probably have to move those rates. When they do move those rates, they'll also have to move the variable rates. And that's why analysts and myself do think that those variable rates are about to move. And AIB, as I say, already moved them in February. So we're already in that cycle.
Right, okay. What about first-time buyers? Not that there's a huge deal of activity in that regard, but someone applying for a mortgage for the first time. And I suppose that's where, whether you can do it now or in a couple of months, it might there might be some difference in what you can get the rate at, the fixed rate, perhaps.
Yeah, so I mentioned that 3.19% yeah. rate that's available. I'm expecting that to be withdrawn from the market any day now. It's been there for about 9 months, and it's extremely attractive. What will happen is, because the ECB put refinance rate goes up, the cost of funds to the lenders go up. And therefore, when they issue fixed rates, they will increase those fixed rates. So we would expect those fixed rates that are available to increase, and that will make things tougher again on hard-pressed first-time buyers. You're right, Greg.
Yeah, and I mean, obviously, the argument for inflation rises. Sorry, the argument for interest rate rises is to suppress, isn't it, inflation? But we are looking now at the next budget, where the government is looking at helping people out with their mortgages to help them with the increased cost of interest rates. It kind of seems a bit odd to me. In other words, it's state money then, really, that's just being flooded into the banks again. Maybe it's not that simple, but if interest rates is to drive down inflation, yet the government is assisting people with the cost of inflation, it seems all counterintuitive to me. I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do, but it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, there is an element of the right arm not knowing what the left arm is doing here. I do think the interest rate increases really are pretty much the only policy lever that the central bank that's tasked with bringing inflation back down to 2% has. And around the world, this is what this is the medicine that central banks administer to governments to bring inflation back under check. So they will definitely keep doing this. I mean, and they've.
But do you know what's crazy about that, Mark? And I know this is not about mortgages, but inflation is being driven by artificially high energy prices, right? Because the companies aren't passing on the savings, and also food. And food is essential to live. Food inflation is the cost of food is what's another key element to the inflation. So what do they want us not to eat? You know, but they're giving us less money not to eat with. Anyway, a caller says, "Hi, Greg, I'm on a tracker mortgage. It's up €300 extra a month from last year." I mean, that's huge, Mark. €3,600 extra. How many of us could just absorb that? What do they do?
I mean,
what do they do at this point?
The really important thing to say here is the numbers that I've just talked about are averages. So within those averages, there are a lot of different stories. There are customers who've seen very little increase because they don't have many years left. They don't have much amount on their mortgage. But there are, on the flip side of that, customers who've really seen massive increases. Now, if you can switch, if you're not one of those mortgage prisoners, As I'd said before, Greg, I'd definitely get in touch with a broker. There are still very good fixed rates. I know people have been concerned because, and I think this has been one of the problems, frankly, because of the tracker mortgage scandal back in 2008, it was drummed into people back then, and it was good advice back then. Don't give up your tracker. And you know, people are fearful because so many people lost out when they did give up their trackers. So get proper advice, talk to a broker, but I really wouldn't sit on your hands. If you are, you know, not one of the 60,000 mortgage prisoners, and most people aren't, most, you know, 100,000 of the 130,000 tracker customers can still switch. Get on the phone and do it soon, because those low fixed rates, literally, I'm waiting for the lenders to tell us that they're withdrawing those from the market any day now. So the time, really, the window. The good news is the window hasn't closed. The bad news is the window is about to close.
All right, caller says, when Bank of Scotland left Ireland, loans were transferred to Pepper. Pepper cannot offer any fixed rates. They're just servicing the loan. That's a person that's trapped, is it?
Yeah, that is a great example. And this is a misconception about the Vulture Funds. The Vulture Funds basically took a load of loan sales, a load of different business. So the people who were on Danske Bank and in Bank of Scotland Ireland, they were all transferred over to Vulture Funds that are administered by Pepper. They can't fix. Now, those customers typically, by the way, are the ones that aren't prisoners, that they actually have got the affordability and that they can switch. But not everybody knows that. What we're finding is a load of people think, I'm with the Vulture Fund, there's nothing I can do. Again, talk to a broker, somebody who's reputable and has all the lenders, and you may be able to switch away and get on a decent rate.
All right, last one here. With Ulster Bank and my mortgage hasn't been transferred yet, I'm stuck in limbo at the moment because I can't switch to a non-tracker rate. What can I do?
Yeah, there is a small sliver of Ulster Bank customers who had a product which was called a split, which was quite an innovative product. And the problem that they face is that no bank has the equivalent product. So they've been completely stuck in limbo. As far as I know, I'm not aware of any options for that customer group at the moment.
Is that where you pay half the mortgage interest only, is it? Is that what...
It's actually where it was a merger of the current account and the mortgage. So it actually meant the balance you had in your current account offset mortgage amount. And it was a great product. But unfortunately, now those customers are trapped. One thing that I would say is we do have a campaign around mortgage prisoners. So people who do find themselves trapped, we have got an email address and we are trying to raise the profile and also give people support. So if somebody does find themselves in that situation, they can email us on mortgageprisoner@moneysherpa.ie and we will get back to them, and we'll either try and raise the profile in the media, because a lot of people, there's a stigma here, a lot of people don't want to talk about it, and they should, and that will help us kind of get action with the government.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, as I say, some people think they're trapped and they're not. So we are finding sometimes we talk to people and we're able to find solutions.
All right, Mark, listen, thanks for your time as always. It's greatly appreciated, and hopefully that gives people some clarity. Take care.
Thanks, Greg.
All right, that's Mark Cullen there, founder of MoneySherpa.ie. So hopefully, as I say, mortgages and mortgage decisions are things we can have a tendency to hide away from or shy away from. So hopefully in that piece there, you have a full understanding of what's happening with mortgage interest rate hikes, the ECB hikes, and what impact it may well have on you. Now, delighted to welcome back onto the programme Donacha O'Bachoin. Good morning, Donacha. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, we're speaking to you this time in the context of this footage, amazing footage from multiple angles, it has to be said, of a drone attack in Moscow, which the Russians has claimed was an assassination attempt on Vladimir Putin. Zelensky out saying that we don't attack Russia, we don't attack Putin, we don't attack Moscow, we fight in our own territory. And of course, as you can imagine, Donacha, and I suppose we're all part of it, everyone has their views, particularly on social media. What's your analysis of what happened?
Well, there's a number of angles you can look at this from. One of them is, can you hear me?
Loud and clear, yes.
Oh, yeah, sorry. So there's a number of angles that you can look at this from. I mean, one is that we have footage of the attack, and that in itself is of interest because it means the Kremlin wants us to see this. There was an actual assassination that took place outside the Kremlin walls 8 years ago of Putin's main opponent, a man called Boris Nemtsov. And interestingly enough, despite the fact that it took place right beside the Kremlin, no CCTV cameras or footage could be presented at that time, let alone disseminated. But now we have, from multiple angles, from, you know, obviously Kremlin-controlled CCTV, footage of this attack. And therefore, we have to ask ourselves, you know, why is the Kremlin interested in seeing this? Because, you know, at face value, if we were to believe it, it's quite an audacious attack. It would be a humiliation for Moscow in many respects because, you know, the Kremlin should be one of the most guarded and indeed is one of the most guarded power centers in the world. You would think that the air defense systems would be such that no drone would be able to get through. Drones are relatively slow and vulnerable. Ukraine succeeds in taking down most of them before they land on their targets. So how it would manage to more or less strike the Kremlin is remarkable. And when you think of how in the past the Kremlin has responded to actual successful Ukrainian attacks, such as the sinking of the flagship Moskva in the Black Sea, you might remember that last year in April, the Kremlin went to extraordinary lengths not to be humiliated. And they came up with the ever more exotic excuses. You know, they said that it was a fire because of somebody smoking on the ship, that it wasn't a missile attack, that the ship sank because of a storm, when it seemed to all and sundry that this was a successful Ukrainian strike. So why this, you might say, more modest attack, at least in military terms, not in terms of symbolism, of course, why they're publicizing this is very interesting in itself. I mean, if it was an assassination attempt, as the Kremlin is claiming, it was a remarkably modest effort because, you know, Putin, firstly, is rarely in the Kremlin, so they weren't even going to get him at home. He usually stays in his residence west of Moscow. And in fact, wouldn't it be make much more sense to attack him when he's known to be in the open at 10 a.m. on the 9th of May, when he has to be in Red Square for the 9th of May Victory Day celebrations? So why would you, you know, not wait until then if you were planning an attack on the Kremlin? So there's lots of questions out there.
But another question then, let's just say this was a false flag. What would Putin and his administration need such a false flag event for? I mean, they can, obviously, and they do, bomb Ukraine at will, or, you know, whenever they want to. What might this, is this to try and whip up Russian support, if indeed it was in fact a false flag, and everyone has different views? Like, what would be the advantage to Putin and his administration in creating this false flag event? Because obviously they would have to accept, as you've pointed out, that it does to some extent make them look weak. So where would be the upside for Russia?
Well, that's an excellent question, Greg, and that really gets to the nub of the matter, because they are playing with fire if they have orchestrated this. So it begs the question, well, why? Is it to justify an escalation? Well, you would say that they've probably thrown everything they can at Ukraine. So why would they need to have the self-inflicted, you know, negative PR story, you know, to justify a further escalation? And it's not, of course, that they haven't done that in the past. One might remember when Putin came to power first in 1999, there were the bombings in Moscow and Volgodonsk, which was used to justify an all-out war against Chechnya. Interestingly, Dmitry Medvedev, who was, of course, for 4 years president of Russia and very much allied to to Vladimir Putin. He said yesterday that this attack on the Kremlin justified the physical elimination of Vladimir Zelensky and his cabinet. But again, you're left thinking, haven't they been trying that from day one? I mean, they started with an attack on Kyiv back in February of last year. So the second point that you raise may be about mobilizing, enthusing the Russian population that they face this existential threat, you know, maybe somewhere closer to the truth. Of course, the mobilization last September was very lackluster. It prompted hundreds of thousands of Russians to flee Russia. So perhaps that might be it. But there's another intriguing possibility, and that there's some kind of internal power struggle within the Russian political elite, that this may not have been authorized by the government, but by somebody else. You know, it does smack up that very exotic story from 1987. I'm certainly old enough to remember when a young German man, Matthäus Rust, he landed a plane. He managed to fly it into Red Square, and it landed right beside the Kremlin. And of course, it led to a huge reevaluation of the Soviet Union's defense. And the Gorbachev sacked the defense minister and the commander of the air defense. So maybe there's some kind of internal, you know, maneuverings going on within the defense sector that they're trying to demonstrate that, you know, the leadership isn't doing its job properly. Mm. And maybe there's other people trying to, you know, get promoted. Who knows?
Greatly scale down public involvement in Victory Day celebrations, and maybe if they can present a threat in Moscow, that might make the public feel that, oh, right, okay, I understand what they're doing. Because if I understand or read correctly, Donoghue, you know better than I, of course you do, part of the celebrations is that people will walk through the streets holding pictures of loved ones that would have died in war, normally the Second World War. Russia might be afraid of an awful lot of people walking the streets with pictures of the hundreds of thousands of people potentially that have died in the last couple of years, and that would not play very well, I'd imagine.
Well, that's an excellent observation. And again, it's one of the possible theories, you know, because this Victory Day is certainly like no other. There's no victory to celebrate. And the Kremlin must be wary at this stage, this very delicate stage of its war against Ukraine, of any mass mobilization, even if it's state orchestrated. As you say, it could be a vehicle for people to parade with their photographs of their loved ones that have died in the conflict in Ukraine, because traditionally, as you say, it's usually, you know, family members of veterans who died in World War II who parade. But, you know, who's to say that it could end up being something else? Already, governors of regions in Russia had communicated to the Kremlin that they were canceling their regional parade. So already in advance of this attack, if it is such on the Kremlin, there were already moves to downscale this and to lower expectations about what Victory Day celebrations might look like. Certainly, this will be a Victory Day celebration like no other in Russia.
Yeah, and history showed us too that often these days of celebration can actually turn into days of protest. Just briefly, Donoghue, if you don't mind, what do we expect over the next couple of months? Because we've been hearing about this Ukrainian offensive for quite some time now, and even the fact that they're perhaps, because of leaks, keeping some of that information and planning to themselves and not even letting on to international partners. And then we hear that Russia's planning something as well. What do the next couple of months have in store for us, Donoghue, as we watch on this awful situation?
Well, what we know is that Ukraine has taken a beating over the last couple of months in terms of this kind of terrorist attack on the civilian infrastructure. I mean, we often forget when we look at spectaculars like the attack on the Kremlin that, you know, just yesterday, 21 people were killed in a massive Russian attack on the city of Kherson, which was recaptured by the Ukrainians in November. A few days ago, 19 people were killed when an apartment block was killed in the central Ukrainian town of Uman. So this goes on every day. And indeed, this morning, we've had attacks in Kyiv and in other Ukrainian cities in Zaporizhia and Odessa. So that's kind of the drone attacks, that's the air attack. But we then have the war of attrition in Donbass, where the front line is. And the Russians have thrown everything at capturing Bakhmut, which is a city about the size of Galway. And it's completely depopulated. But they haven't captured it after several months of trying. Estimated Russian losses are 20,000. It's been a remarkable lack of success. And during this time, Ukraine has been promised and has now received more than 250 state-of-the-art tanks, 1,500 armored vehicles, and all signs are that they're preparing for a major counteroffensive. The question is where, of course, it will target, because as you might might remember in previous counteroffensives, they were quite good at keeping it secret up until the last moment, and indeed giving the impression they were going to attack somewhere else. So they made a point of not showing their hand, and even to their allies, and therefore the first people who probably will know about this counteroffensive are the Russians themselves when they feel the artillery.
Donoghue, thank you so much for your time as always. I greatly appreciate it.
Not at all, Greg.
Okay, take care of yourself. That's Donoghue O'Beacoin, who is a professor of politics at the School of Law and Government, Dublin City University, where he lectures on post-Soviet politics, unrecognised states and Irish politics as well. A caller says, if you want to talk about a false flag, how about America and Iraq and weapons of mass destruction? Yeah, indeed, that was the biggest false flag of them all. But that's some time ago now. We're talking about what's happening today. But I take your point. Okay, let's take a break. An email here. Hi, Greg. I'm sitting in the emergency department in Letterkenny Hospital. Myself, my sister and my mum, who has stage 4 cancer, and she was at her GP yesterday morning, and she referred her straight away to go to the hospital as she has fluid in her right lung and she's breathless and in a lot of pain. And we went into the hospital at 1 p.m. yesterday. It's now 9:30 in the morning and she still hasn't got a bed. It's an absolute disgrace that a cancer patient has to sit this long to be admitted. This hospital is a complete mess. The many people that were waiting to see, young and old, it is just heartbreaking in this day and age. Can nothing be done? They're spending money on this and that. But what else would you expect from this joke of a state? We're sitting here with our poor mother and there's nothing we can do to help her. Thank you, Greg. Would you please highlight this with something seriously needs to be done. Kind regards. Another scandalous, the number of hospital trolleys yesterday. It's now treated as normal. Same with the housing crisis and homelessness. All our young sons and daughters emigrating, which is heartbreaking to parents. More contacts about people being told in the ED last evening who'd been sitting there for much of the day that if they can go, to go. But the one thing we hear time and time again is that people are sympathetic to the staff, that they are trying their best in very difficult circumstances. Neil Donoghue is Industrial Relations Officer with the INMO covering the Northwest, and he joins us now. Not surprising then to hear from your members that 9 out of 10 of them say they were at least somewhat burnt out because of the workload and the conditions they're working in, Neil.
Absolutely, and thanks for having me on. Just to make a point, I mean, that story that you've just shared, Greg, it absolutely is shocking, and our members share a desperate. I do have to say that in Letterkenny Hospital, we have seen improvements in recruitment over the last couple of years, but it's just the attendance levels are massively, massively high. There isn't enough space. We keep hearing from management for all the patients, and equally our view is that there are not enough staff in order to carry out the workload. And that burden is very, very real. You know, there's an emotional burden for the staff there who feel guilty for what their patients go through. They want better standards. They're members of the community also. They may be service users also themselves. And they want to have a better health system. But it's just not functioning to a level that we believe is safe or that our members believe is safe. And we want to see that change desperately.
What needs to be changed then? Because this can't continue. We can't have a situation where almost the entire body of nursing staff feel burnt out. Something eventually has to give. We have consultants speaking out saying it's at the point now whereby, despite their best efforts, they have to almost treat patients like numbers. So what changes to improve this situation?
Well, capacity is something that we keep hearing from the HSE is a problem, and that's going to require significant investment and time in order to put in place. But this is a very immediate problem. We can't wait 6 months or 2 years or whatever it will take to have that capacity built. In this moment in time, what we believe is required is to have the right staffing levels there in order to deal with it. No matter how many people are attending, if you have more staff there that are highly skilled, highly capable, then you'll improve the flow of patients and improve the outcomes. And again, there's evidence of that. I mean, there is an evidence-based tool to decide safe staffing in Ireland now. The difficulty is it isn't fully implemented and not fully funded. And we need to see that in Letterkenny Hospital. We know that just looking, based on that evidence-based tool, looking at Letterkenny medical wards, surgical wards, and the ED alone, they need at least an extra 60 nurses for that. Now, that's not taking account of all areas. That's just for the medical, surgical, and emergency department. So you can see it's a massive deficit. I mean, there's members there where on their goodwill that service is running, that, you know, when a shift isn't filled for whatever reason, if there's a massive influx of patients, if there's a very high demand, they come in, do extra hours to help out, or they'll stay on maybe to do an extra hour as an addition onto a very long and difficult shift already in order to help their colleagues out and to help out the patients that they see suffering every day.
Yes, but I mean, how are we going to recruit into a health service with this type of an advertisement going out?
Well, listen, we have to start by fixing the problem. We can't shy away from that. And it is a genuine problem. Like I said, there's an evidence-based tool that is sitting on a table waiting to be fully implemented. And we believe when that's done, it's not just about recruiting people in, it's about retaining the staff that are already there. We hear every day of people that are leaving because of that burnout. If there was an extra pair of hands to help them with that workload, it might encourage them to stay, and we stop that constant cycle of losing the absolutely brilliant experience that exists amongst nurses and midwives.
Yeah, and obviously people probably thought the pressures through COVID were a temporary thing, but it seems to be permanent now in that we're not talking about winter plans anymore. We're talking about an all-year-round type of a plan. Presumably, staff feel they're not getting any break, or they can't steady themselves or get back to a steady footing pre-COVID, as bad as it was then, if you know what I mean.
Absolutely. It's become an absolute constant. We used to talk about the winter surge, but people will say now that during the summertime, it's almost the exact same. There's really no reprieve at all. They're working at full pace all the time. No rest, no let up. I suppose, when you're talking about a winter plan, I mean, the winter plan is very seldom, if ever, in on time in order to address the concerns in advance of the winter. We want to see, I suppose, the HSE being more proactive. And again, it's a yearly plan. They know every single year that there's going to be a surge. It shouldn't wait until the last minute to put measures in place. And the difficulty with that, and we saw this back in December and January in particular, where there was massively high attendance in the acute hospitals, is that it always falls to the people at the coalface. It will fall to the nurse or the midwife that is there to pick up the pieces because of a failure to plan. And that, again, is going to impact very negatively on retention. We know a lot of people have left the acute hospitals, maybe with 20 years experience in an ED, you know, that type of skill level, that type of experience and knowledge level, bleeding out from hospitals because of that failure to plan and because of the pressure they're under. And they're not just leaving the country. They're going to community areas as well. But realistically, if the hospital problem is going to improve, they have to really work on retention. Using that evidence-based tool is key. It has to be a solid, stable foundation that we're all working off.
The Health Minister has announced the funding for about 800 extra nurses through this year's budget. He made that announcement, obviously, before he's due to address the conference. Is that good news, or is it about how is that going to be delivered, or... how will that news be received, or how is it being received?
It's absolutely good news to hear that there's investment. I mean, again, we know that if you invest in nursing, that you will improve the patient outcomes. We've seen that in studies that were done. Again, you know, even reducing the number of secondary admissions. I mean, the hospitals, a lot of people say it's almost like a revolving door for patients, that they go in, they get treated, that they maybe are leaving too swiftly and they're back in again a couple of weeks later. When you invest in nursing and improve the nursing workforce levels, you actually improve the patient outcome as well. So it should help reduce that. But again, like I said, it's great to see the investment, but retention is key here. There's a lot of people, like we said, that are leaving because of the exceptionally difficult conditions. So great to have the funding to bring people in, but keeping them there is what's key. We can't just have staff coming and leaving and keeping that cycle perpetuating.
What kind of reception do you think the minister will get in front of delegates? I mean, recently we saw the head of the An Garda Síochána Síochána not get a very favourable reception in front of the GRA. What do you think? What is the view of Stephen Donnelly amongst nurses?
I think our members are steadfast. They're absolutely resolute in this, that there must be safe staffing. We're not asking for... I don't believe it's a massive request. It's just asking for safety for the patient, safety for the staff. And that has to be achieved. So I'm hopeful that he'll have some positive things to say on that. As for how it'll be received by the members, they're well able to speak for themselves. They're very vocal on this issue. And I'm glad to see that he's coming today to hear what they have to say.
Okay, Neil, thanks for your time this morning. I appreciate it. That's Neil Donoghue, who is the INMO's Industrial Relations Officer covering the North West. And we shall see a little later on what kind of reception Stephen Donnelly receives. 086 60 25000. A caller called in to say, why can't the triage nurse send you for an X-ray or bloods to the lab while you're waiting for a doctor? Another says that woman shouldn't have to go through the ED. It should be straight into the oncology ward. But unfortunately, we were speaking to a gentleman last week whose mother was sitting in an ambulance outside ED for 4 or 5 hours. She was a cancer patient as well. And that was the question he posed. Why is she not being admitted to oncology? Why is she having to sit in an ambulance outside the ED? It didn't make sense last week and it doesn't make sense this week.